This is the Monday Morning Quarterback Podcast with Andy Benoit and your host, John Engel.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the MMQB Podcast with Andy Benoit. I'm John Engel at Engel's Angle on Twitter. You can follow Andy at Andy_Benoit. You can find us on iTunes. Make it easier for yourself and just subscribe and you'll get it in your inbox in the morning. Just search MMQB Podcast. We're also on SoundCloud. So here's how the show will break down. We'll spend 45 minutes on the wild card games, and then we'll get to all these coaching changes from around the league and the candidates who will fill those positions. And we'll get to Arizona, Carolina here in a minute. But first, let's talk about Pittsburgh and Baltimore. Pittsburgh's coming into this game pretty hot, while, as we've seen in the past, the Ravens are stumbling into the playoffs once again.
Yeah, they are. I don't know how much that matters. I understand that you want to do momentum and all that stuff going into the playoffs. You want to be playing well, but we both know...
You in quotations,
yeah,
not
momentum's
me.
Not a real thing. Now, that it's a word that people who don't understand what they're watching use to describe a team that's playing well. And you do want to be playing well going into the postseason, but that's not vital either. It's very much a week-to-week league, and I think that's especially true when in a game like this where you're playing a team for the third time and you see them at least twice every year. So... yeah, Baltimore is limping in, but I don't think that factors once the kickoff
and
happens.
And also the concept that a bunch of grown professional men are pouting after a loss that they can't just come in and win in the playoffs too.
Yeah, I mean, and Baltimore's done this before. When they went to the Super Bowl, they won some road games. So it's going to be a great, great matchup like it always is with these teams.
Let's talk about the offensive side of the ball for the Steelers. The defensive side of the ball for the Ravens. How do you defend Ben Roethlisberger as he's evolved into – a new kind of passer that we're not used to. Less of the sandlot play, more pocket presence.
Yeah, and that's what's dangerous is that he hasn't replaced the sand. Well, he's replaced it, but he still has the ability to be a sandlot player when need be. So Roethlisberger, as this pocket passer, he has really expanded his game. And we don't hear much criticism of Todd Haley these days, do we, anymore?
No, those first couple of weeks, though, the Steelers fans were coming out in droves.
Yeah, well, and led by Snoop Dogg, who's a great leader of men. And that that's suddenly vanished now. Maybe Todd Haley knew what he was doing all along, and I think he did, and I think it's a great system that they have. And so I think one reason Roethlisberger's so comfortable in the pocket now is there's a rhythm to his game, and it comes from these quick throws, these wide receiver screens, which I think are an extension of their rushing attack, but they count as pass plays. They get you. You're still throwing the ball. You're in a rhythm. You're developing chemistry. And then when Martavis Bryant entered the lineup as well, that lifted the top off of defenses, and now you're getting different looks. And something – Pittsburgh does three things. They do those wide receiver screens. They run counter. And the other thing they do is throw at the intermediate levels off of play action. And I think that's where the Bryant factor really shows up. Another thing is when you throw in play action, you're facing base defenses because you're in your own two tight end sets, or sometimes, in their case, David Johnson or Will Johnson in a fullback. But for the most part, you're going to be facing base defenses when you do that. And so that's probably also helped Roethlisberger a bit.
Roethlisberger just shy of 5,000 yards this season. That's a career high completion percentage. We talk about this all the time, even with great and talented quarterbacks, that simplifying the offense helps everyone. And we're seeing that with Ben, right? Is that what you see on the film?
Well, I don't know if we'd call it simplifying so much. It's just the game becomes simpler. And it's a function of the look you get from the defense, which comes from what you're doing on offense. But that doesn't necessarily mean you're calling simple plays. There are some basic concepts in that they're learning to execute well. And that in and of itself is important because for the longest time, Roethlisberger could not do the basic stuff on a consistent basis. He was very much a sporadic player. He just happened to be a really, really good one. Well, now he's a consistent player with sporadic skills if he needs them.
So then which Big Ben is harder to defend? The Benny the Jet sandlot Big Ben, or is it the pocket presence that you fear the most as a
Benny
defense?
The Jet sandlot is a sandlot reference.
You had to.
It's winter, man. This isn't a summer. We're going to save that for the summer.
You can't
test.
Throw out sandlot and not think of the PF Flyers and Benny the Jet going all the way.
I agree with you. I think this Ben's harder to defend because there's more to him, like we've said. But I think what you're wanting to discuss and what we need to discuss is conceptually which type of quarterback's harder to play against. And it goes back, it's almost like that Kaepernick Manning discussion we had mid-season. I think that was around week 7.
Yeah.
When I wrote that in that article, and more of the defensive coaches in the league said that they'd rather face Manning than Kaepernick. I don't, in this case, The problem when you face a runaround guy like with Roethlisberger is he breaks down your coverage principles. Coverages are based on certain rules, and those rules fall apart when the offense doesn't play by its rules. When Roethlisberger goes out of order to read his progressions, which he doesn't do anymore, but when he used to, and you didn't know what order he was going to read guys in, how do you plan your coverage disguises and rotations? And if you're a guy like Ed Reed, or in this case now who's playing free safety, I guess Will Hill's the new Ed Reed, that sounds off. But, you know, when you're a free safety that studies tape and studies the opponent, and the opponent doesn't have a pattern to his play, that might drive the offense crazy, but that can also drive heady defensive players crazy. So that's a very hard Roethlisberger to play against. Having said that, I think this one's harder, this precision passing Big Ben, because of the weapons he has around him now.
Yeah, the weapons that Roethlisberger has makes that really tough too. But Le'Veon Bell may be out this week. I guess tests are negative on torn ligaments in the knee, but he seems to be in a lot of pain, having trouble even walking.
Well, and it's early in the week that we're recording this, so maybe things will change during the week. But
hopefully for us, I want to see Le'Veon Bell.
I do too. I don't like seeing any injuries, but I don't especially like seeing star players go down right before the postseason. Now, let's talk conceptually. Could they survive without Le'Veon Bell? And I think they could for this game. I think especially you look at if the pass protection holds up, which Pittsburgh's pass pro has been outstanding lately. And what's most encouraging is it seems to get better each week. In fact, that whole offensive line, even what they do in the power run game with the interior blockers playing on the move, DeCastro and Mike and Marquise Pouncey, it's a borderline great offensive line at times, and they've been very good in the pass protection. So if that holds up against the Ravens pass rush, then you're talking about the Steelers' litany of wide receivers going against a Baltimore secondary that still doesn't have its personnel fully established yet. So I think if you're throwing on first and 10 there, or in some cases you're going to be, if say Bell's out and things really don't go well, and now it's second and 14, I still think you've got a shot if you're Pittsburgh. I think, and certainly if you're ahead in the down and distance, you've got a real chance to destroy that Ravens secondary.
How can not having a guy with the dimensions that Le'Veon Bell has, though, if not having him on the field, that has to limit your offense considerably? The way you've talked about how he's used as that fifth wide receiver out of the backfield on every down, you can't plug and play with him.
No question. I mean, is it better to have Le'Veon Bell in this game than not have Le'Veon Bell? Yes, of course. Everybody agrees on that. And it might be a different story if Pittsburgh is to win this game and they'd go on to play, I guess it'd be Denver in the second round. We might be having a different discussion. But for this game and the way they match up to Baltimore, I think they can survive the Le'Veon Bell absence, because let's just pose this question. What happens when Antonio Brown goes in the slot? Who's going to cover him? Because last I checked, Baltimore had a safety, Matt Elam, playing the slot. So either you're going to have a safety on Antonio Brown and you'll double team him in that case if you can. He can't always double guys. Even if you can, that's a 1.5 man coverage on Brown, because Elam can't compete against Brown. Or you're going to move an outside cornerback inside to play the slot. Now we're talking about more shuffling of your secondary personnel. It's not a good secondary in Baltimore. And at some point, that's going to catch up to them unless their pass rush can be dominant, which then gets back into who's going to win in the trenches in this game.
But to that point, one less guy to watch if you're a stumbling secondary. That's a huge bonus for Baltimore now that, yeah, it's hard to defend Antonio Brown, but you don't have Le'Veon Bell there to worry about.
You're right. And how that bonus would translate is in the last game, the Steelers had a lot of success with taking Le'Veon Bell out of the backfield and motioning to an empty set. And when you do that, Baltimore almost always defends in one of two ways. They put either Darryl Smith on the running back when he motions out, or they'll put their other linebacker, Mosley, on the running back when he motions out. And last game, when these teams matched up, it was Mosley, and he got his lunch fed to him by Bell. So now if you're not having to worry so much about a guy motioning out, or let's answer it this way. If Pittsburgh feels less inclined to motion a running back out, because if Dre Archer motions out, you still got to go put somebody on him. But if Pittsburgh feels less inclined to go to those empty sets because Bell's out of the game, this is just a big if, But now all of a sudden you have an extra body in coverage or to pass rush or whatever you want to do with those guys. And when you give the Ravens an extra body, they're pretty good because those bodies, those linebackers are good players and they're excellent green dog blitzers, which a green dog, for those who don't know, is if you have a guy in man coverage and he stays in and blocks, then instead of just standing around doing nothing in the middle of the field, you blitz and be in that the man defender turns into a blitzer. Baltimore is good with those concepts. I think Pittsburgh would just motion Dre Archer out anyway, though. He's probably a guy you could try to throw some screens to, in fact.
A big, big piece in that defense for the Ravens that helps get that pressure on the quarterback. Haloti Ngata is back this week after being out since week 13. That suspension for banned substances. What does he bring back to this team that actually performed pretty well on defense while he was away, only allowed 15 points per game in his absence?
Yeah, they didn't miss him, and it was apparent on film that they did not miss him. Timmy Jernigan, the second-round rookie, looked good. He's getting more and more snaps each week. That might curtail now that Nada's back. The other guy I love, and I think I've talked about him before. I've certainly written about him, and I know I've tweeted about him because he showed up in my film notes every game all year long, is Brandon Williams, their last year's third-round pick, who's their nose tackle, and Nada's not necessarily their nose tackle every down, so you can play Williams alongside Nada. In fact, they did a lot earlier, but Brandon Williams has become a force in and of himself. And then there's still Chris Canty as well. So there are guys around Nada. Now, what I would argue is that it was a good thing Haloti Ngata got suspended, at least it is now, because I think you get a fresh Haloti Ngata late in the year. I mean, he got to take a month off, and at his age and his size and his wear and tear, that's got to be beneficial to him, I would think.
And as you always say, gives you those opportunities to see what else you have behind one of your cornerstone guys.
Yeah, and the other thing is Nada's very versatile. He can play outside or inside. He's not an edge rusher, of course, but they're multiple with their fronts when they have Ngata. And the Baltimore Ravens are always multiple with their fronts. But Canty's like that, Jernigan's like that, and Haloti Ngata's like that. And Pernell McPhee, another guy who sometimes lines up in the defensive tackle spot. He even got some reps as an outside linebacker / defensive end a few weeks ago. That's a very versatile, multidimensional front, and Ngata only adds to that.
We mentioned the big questions for Baltimore in their secondary. Pittsburgh's secondary not exactly shored up either, with Ike Taylor and Troy Polamalu both missing some time recently. If they're not significant pieces in this game, does that change Baltimore's approach?
Interesting. Baltimore's approach. I would say that's a fascinating question. I'll tell you why. Because the Polamalu factor gets into coaches' philosophies on how they approach football. I talk to coaches all the time in Mobile and in Indianapolis at the Combine about Polamalu. I'd say guys like Polamalu, but he's the only guy like him. And how you approach it, because you don't know where he's going to be. And so it almost gets back to what we were talking about with Roethlisberger and how if he doesn't follow regular principles of execution, if he doesn't follow the rules of the play design, how do you prepare for that? If he's a bad player, you go into that loving that. But when they're great Hall of Fame talents, how do you prepare for that? So, yeah, it does change Baltimore's approach. I don't know in what way, though, because I don't know how they interpret Polamalu, but I'm sure they interpret him differently than they interpret Will Allen.
Especially since Pittsburgh's defense, though, has always been impossible to predict. I mean, there's no predictability
That's
in what
That's the Polamalu
you're
factor.
That all has to do with Polamalu.
Well, not all of it, but a lot of it. And especially, Phil Simms made a great point. In fact, I think it may have been when the Baltimore Ravens played Pittsburgh and early in the year, I think it was week 2.
Yes.
On CBS, a Thursday night game. If it was either that game or another one, but he said that years ago the Steelers were unpredictable because they did these fire zone blitzes out of the 3-4 and out of the nickel package, these double A gap pressure stuff, and it worked real well, and so the rest of the league copied it. And what happened was that became kind of more well no, not kind of, that became the norm. And so Pittsburgh became kind of less unpredictable. Not predictable, but less unpredictable. So Polamalu's, yeah, it is. It's 90% Polamalu these days, 10% the blitz factor. But if he's not in there, it's a somewhat predictable defense. They're not going to throw a lot at the Ravens that they haven't seen before. They'll throw some stuff, but they're not going to have 10 or 12 snaps like that.
How about the Ravens running game? Coming off that 129-yard performance against the Browns in Week 17, Week 16, though, only 33 yards. It was abysmal running attack for the Ravens. You see that being more of a factor moving into the playoffs?
Well, they have to run the ball to be effective. We talked about that last week. We were worried about their running game. And it's nice that they ran the ball well on Cleveland. But, you know, Cleveland did not have a very good run defense this year, which still baffles me. But they're not in the playoffs, so we won't elaborate on that. Their play-action stuff is tied to the running game, obviously, and their play-action's based on a lot of zone stretch stuff. That's ideally, that's how Kubiak wants to play as their offensive coordinator. He hasn't done that as much here as he did in Houston, but that's his ideal method. And so if you're not running the ball effectively, then you're limited in your play-action. And also, you can't run play-action on second down and 12 because it's less believable.
So can the Ravens win without that then? If you're ready to change the script or the tendencies that you've had for most of the season, seems like a bad time to start messing with things.
It is a bad time. I think they could win this game without it because I'm not a big believer in that Steelers pass rush. I know it's come to life a little bit. In fact, it came back to life when these teams met last time and James Harrison had his emergence. You know, it looked like the old James Harrison again. That's not going to happen the second time. There's no way Eugene Monroe and Kelechi Osemele at left guard are going to be that fooled by stunts and twists and stuff that, again, they're going to be ready for what Pittsburgh throws at them. And Pittsburgh at some point is going to have to win one-on-one matchups. And I don't know who's going to win those. I mean, Jason Worlds has not been – he's not a guy that wins one-on-one pass rush scenarios. He's a guy that needs help through the scheme. Jarvis Jones has not been a factor this year. If Harrison's playing against Monroe, I guess Monroe sat out last week, so I don't know where his health is. Maybe that's more of a matchup. But on an island one-on-one, I think Monroe has a good shot at being effective in that game. So I think Baltimore can get by with a pass-only approach against Pittsburgh because they've got receivers, they've got a big-arm quarterback, and I'm not a big believer in the Steelers' pass rush.
I'm so excited for this game, specifically after this discussion. I have no idea who has the edge.
I don't either.
You know?
I know,
you hate words like that, but well, where's the advantage?
I don't like to predict because then all that happens is the Twitter trolls come out
and not just
the Twitter. And I don't care about them finding me, but they don't listen to anything that we're talking about. They just go off of the prediction. It's just the same reason I don't predict stuff on the thing. If I knew predictions, I wouldn't be doing this.
Yeah,
I would
you'd
go
make
live
a lot
Las-
more money.
Yeah, I go live in Las Vegas and become a rich guy. I understand football and how teams approach it, but I can't tell you who's going to win or lose, and these guys in the NFL can't. I think Pittsburgh being at home, that doesn't hurt them. They're more stable. That Le'Veon Bell's a big factor, though. It does change a lot.
We'll have to watch that.
They can survive it, that doesn't mean I'm anxious to go picking them. But if Baltimore's run game is – let's ask this. Who do we think could win? If this is a pass-only game, theoretically, who's more equipped to win? Because they both have questionable secondaries, and they both have big-time strong-arm quarterbacks, and they both have guys that can lift the top off of a defense with Torrey Smith and Steve Smith, Martavis Bryant and Antonio Brown, and even Marcus Wheaton. So
I'm taking the Steelers set. If I have to choose the weapons, if that's your question, I'm going Steelers every time.
I think I'd go Steelers as well because I believe in Baltimore's O-line. I like it. I love it on the right side, especially in the run game. But I think Pittsburgh's offensive line is playing better now, and therefore they have a chance for their offense to function at its fullest.
The team that Pittsburgh defeated in Week 17, Cincinnati Bengals, taking a trip down Interstate 74 to play the Colts. We saw this matchup in Week 7. The Colts shellacked the Bengals 27-0, that blowout win. That's not the type of thing you ever predict going into a playoff game. So let's go from this angle. How have these teams changed? We have this conversation all the time. What's different going into this wildcard round?
Yeah. What's different is Cincy's comfort level in their scheme. So what happened last time, their offense was probably as uncompetitive, non-competitive as any offense was in any game this season. They had eight consecutive three and outs to start the game last time. I mean, they just didn't show up. So on offense, Cincy's going to have their protections set better, I would hope. And that is an ancillary factor because they become a run-based team almost ever since this game. I think they looked at themselves after this game. Maybe it's after the Cleveland game as well that they really took a firm look at themselves. But since he's changed in that, they're a running offense. And then on defense, Indianapolis is the same, by the way. I think on both sides of the ball, same approach, you know, maybe a little better what they do. But the changes are in Cincy's side. So that's the offense's run-based approach. On defense, they were a blitz team, a blitz-oriented team early in the year when they had Vontaze Burfict and the rest of the linebackers healthy. In this game, those linebackers were not healthy, and they became a coverage-based team. And I don't think they were quite equipped to fully play that way yet. I think they were a little uncomfortable. But they've had several weeks of this now, and they remain a coverage-based team, but they're much more comfortable in that identity. So the Colts are seeing a much more stable Bengals defense this time.
What's also significantly different going into this game is week 7, we didn't see the full Jeremy Hill effect for the Bengals either. And since then, he's become the featured piece in the backfield for Cincinnati.
Yeah, he has. And Giovanni Bernard's back, and he's healthy as well. And so that's a great 1-2 punch. Those guys, and it's no accident that they have those two types of runners together, and they've taken them in the second round in the last 2 years, because they complement each other extremely well. And Cincy's offensive line is really equipped to be a running-based team. And Andy Dalton, we'll talk about him, he's equipped to be a complementary quarterback in a run system. But you put that offensive line up there, if you ask them to pass protect, especially against a team like Indianapolis, a 3-4 Pagano-type team that throws a lot of that can throw a lot of different blitzes at you, and that's something they've done real well with in Robert Mathis's absence this year. When you ask the Bengals to play against a team like that, their lack of athleticism becomes apparent. Those guys don't move east and west particularly well. And that's what the Chargers did in the postseason to them last year. They did slants and twists and all kinds of things with their defensive front to get these guys playing at angles where they're not as good. When you ask these guys, Whitworth and I guess now on the right side, it's Eric Winston, and then that interior line, which is full of a bunch of big players, to just go downhill and be a running tight power team, that's where they're at their best. So it's a more comfortable approach overall for the Bengals.
How about the Colts? So the Bengals are typically more comfortable playing a coverage-based defense. Do you think they stick with that going into this week? And what does that mean for Andrew Luck and his passing attack?
I think they do stick with that, because I don't know if they were going to change. I think they would.
Why would you do it now?
And you can do it now, certainly. I mean, that we've seen that before, and it's a team that, you know, it's not like these guys have never blitzed before. They're Cincinnati Bengals. They know the plays on blitzes. But I just think they would have, something else would have convinced Paul Gunther to go in that direction earlier in the year if he were feeling compelled to go in that direction. I don't think they will blitz. They're going to have to get pressure with their four-man front. Every team needs that when they're not blitzing, of course. But in this case, Andrew Luck's so good late in the down, you have to pressure him early on, and it's not a very good Colts offensive line either in terms of athleticism. So this is a week that Cincy's pass rush needs to show up, and I would be a little uncomfortable with that if I'm a Bengals fan, because at times it's a great pass rush with talent at Dunlap and Geno Atkins, but those guys will vanish for long stretches of time too.
We've seen all season long, even with the talented Andrew Luck, no running game there for the Colts, and a lot of pressure just put on Luck's arm. Can you win a Super Bowl with such an inconsistent running game? Is it even possible?
Well, the Giants a few years ago won a Super Bowl, I think, with the dead last ranked rushing attack in the league, the second one against New England. Now, if I recall, and I could be wrong, but if I recall, I think that rushing attack did kind of come to life a little bit down the stretch. I remember Indianapolis also went very far in the playoffs when their rushing attack came to life late in the season, but this Colts rushing attack will not come to life late in the year. There's no evidence that it will. So to answer your question directly, I think you can with these guys, because with Andrew Luck, his ability to play late, if he couldn't play late in the down, I'd be concerned about it. But while you don't want him getting pressured and hitting all that stuff, he can compete when he does that. I mean, he's still a big-time superstar, even when he's got guys draping off of him. So I think they can. That's not the way they want to play, obviously, but it's not impossible given who they have at QB and a wide receiver.
And counting on that week-to-week, though, is really hard to do. Without that running game, it's hard for me, at least, to buy into the Colts, knowing moving forward, it's a lot of Andrew Luck. Reggie Wayne's been banged up these last couple of weeks. It's only one guy.
Yeah, and it doesn't seem like they've had quite as much of a short area passing game as we'd expected. Like, Dwayne Allen hasn't quite been the everyday. You know, a lot of us thought that he would really give dimension and dynamicism to that passing attack as a short receiver. And he's been okay in that regard, but I don't know if that's necessarily come completely true. And then Kobe Fleener is a wildly inconsistent tight end who can draw some matchup problems but also fail when he has some of those. And then I don't know if it's a great screen-throwing team. They've got the resources. Moncrief's very good at that. Hilton, of course. But I don't. When I think of Pittsburgh's passing game, I think they're a good screen-throwing team. That doesn't come to mind when I think of Indianapolis's passing attack.
The Colts are going to be throwing the ball all over the field in this one. Bengals defensive coordinator Paul Gunther, do you see him installing a lot of different pressure concepts in this matchup to mess around with Andrew Luck, knowing that that running game isn't there and you can take a little more risks here and there?
Well, I think they'll be coverage-based, but that doesn't mean they won't do what you just said on some downs. And pressure concepts can also mean showing blitz and not blitzing, because you can still dictate matchups that way. And that's been the Bengals' forte over the years, and that's actually something they've gotten away from as well, those double leg gap looks. I think they will do it, just because if there's enough snaps, you have to mix it up a little bit. Here's what they'll do more likely, though, and I think this is what you have to do against Luck, in fact, is rotate coverages in disguise there. And the way they want to do that, if you can't necessarily blitz or show blitz and show a coverage disguise. You can, but it's not as easy. If you've got those extra bodies back in coverage, you've got seven pieces to work with, you can rotate your coverage from any look to any other concept. Almost all of them are in play. And that's a good way to go against Luck, because you can – he's still a young QB in some ways. You can still bait him into bad throws. We've seen that. And you can confuse his receivers at times. I mean, there's a benefit to showing something and changing the coverage. Heck, they had success doing that against Peyton Manning a few weeks ago.
Let's wrap this one up, circling back around to Andy Dalton. We heard Chris Collinsworth talk Sunday night about Andy Dalton's bit of struggles getting established and getting some momentum. Momentum, that one slipped. Don't call me for that. Rhythm. That's rhythm. What I meant, rhythm.
Yeah, nobody. We're not into momentum.
No momentum,
but,
you can get rhythm, and that'll go to
Dalton. Doesn't have an X factor. He's not going to make a statement. He doesn't have something to prove in this game. Even though he needs to win a playoff game, that's not going to make him a better passer this week.
Have you seen on film that he hasn't been able to establish that rhythm in this run first offense?
Yes, but I don't mean to be flippant here, but when has he established rhythm? I mean, he's done it before. He's had good stretches, but he's not necessarily a rhythmic type of passer. He's a guy that you help. A rhythm passer is someone that can drop back and throw dimes against whatever look he's seeing and get through his progressions. Dalton's a guy that needs to be manipulated by the play call a little bit. He needs to be helped there so that his limitations don't come into play, and he's able to make throws without being moved off his spot and having to make adjustments. He's not very good when he has to make adjustments on the fly. So I don't know if that's as big a deal as someone might want to make it out to be. He's a rhythm passer or not. I'll tell you who he does need to get in rhythm with, though, is throwing to A.J. Green.
Yeah, it helps.
I mean, those two guys have been together now. This is their fourth season together and their fourth trip to the playoffs together. And Green might be out this game with the concussion stuff. I think he'll be okay, but I'm not a doctor. Although I did stay at a Holiday Inn Express last
night. Oh, my God. You didn't
go there.
Sorry,
that was pathetic.
Had you been planning that one for a while?
No, I just said it, and about halfway through I regretted it, but I was already saying I couldn't just stop.
Okay, Dr. Andy Benoit, continue with your thought.
They shouldn't be having as many interceptions as they have, for one. For two, it's the way those interceptions are coming about. They've had 27 of them together now, a league high since, in that four-year span. And so many of them are off of miscommunication. And I've heard these guys don't necessarily communicate well, not off the field, but just from a professional standpoint. Dalton's a very nice guy. He's very accepting of people. And those guys don't necessarily drop the F-bombs in someone's face the way Tom Brady does when an F-bomb needs to be dropped in someone's face. And I think that impacts the way the business is conducted at times in Cincinnati, and it's impacting the way things go about with their best wide receiver. And you can see that stuff on the field, the way it's unfolding, and as these guys walk off the field even. Their communication's not where it needs to be at this point.
Heading over to the NFC, let's start with the Lions and the Cowboys and the obvious spot here. The league's number two rated run game is Dallas. The number one rusher in the league is DeMarco Murray. He's going against this Lions defense that gave up a league-best 69.3 rushing yards per game this year. An incredible running game. Or incredible run defense.
Yeah, well, both. Yeah, running game versus the run defense. Yeah. So who wins is the question. And if Ndamukong Suh's suspension holds up, and again, we're recording this early in the week, and I hope it does hold up because he did that on purpose. Of course, people forget, like Dominic Raiola, who say he didn't mean to stomp on you know the Bear player the other day, and then Suh, who I'm sure he said, if he ever did talk to the media, I'm sure he'd say it was inadvertent. These guys are professional athletes. They're the best in the world at controlling their body and their body's function. They're, very few steps, if any, are ever taken by accident on an NFL field.
I think Nate Burleson, I was watching NFL Network earlier today. I think Nate Burleson pointed it out really well. He first pulls back from being tugged on the jersey, and you see the his foot hit Aaron Rodgers' ankle or his calf area. But then he doesn't move. So once he figures it out, he just stays there.
Well, and he also got him twice. Do you really think he misstepped two times in a row? I mean, it's possible, but his track record, and it's his own fault that he has the track record, says it's not probable. So let's if Sue's out of the game, that's a changer there.
Huge.
Because, especially with Dallas's offensive line as good as it is at center with Travis Frederick and at both guard spots, really, with Leary and especially Zach Martin there on the right side. That's a big, big factor. I think what will be an equally big factor, I'd like to see the Cowboys go into three wide receiver sets and run the ball out of that. I think Green Bay was onto something when they did that in Week 17. They fed Lacy, and they dominated with their ground game early on. Detroit was in a two-high safety look. So if you go in a two-high safety look against a three-receiver set, then there's two high safeties up top, and there's three defenders on those three receivers. If you spread those receivers out, that's five defenders removed from the box. Now you got a six-man box. And DeMarco Murray running against a six-man box, doesn't matter if it has DeAndre Levy in it or not, he's going to win that every time, just like Eddie Lacy won it.
And the absence of Suh doesn't just affect that defensive line. That changes what goes on in the next levels too, right?
It can, because maybe Terrell Austin feels inclined to adjust his scheme then at some point. I mean, if you... Now if Sue's out and Nick Fairley's been out, so a defensive line that was built largely on getting interior pressure doesn't have the same guys generating the pressure. And Andre Flewellens played well in a fill-in spot, and so has Mosley, but that's not Ndamukong Suh. So maybe they are more inclined to blitz, and then that changes what they do with their coverage.
We'll transition over to the Lions' offense against that Cowboys defense with this. Who is more dangerous to defend at wide receiver, Calvin Johnson or Dez Bryant?
I think it's Calvin Johnson. I think most people would agree with that. But the way we need to look at it is Calvin Johnson in Detroit's system or Dez Bryant in Dallas' system, because that's a different twist now. Calvin Johnson does not have DeMarco Murray in that offensive line playing with him. Drake Bell's been a very fine runner. I like Drake Bell a lot. I would, if you told me he's my running back and I have to build an offense, I'm not building it around him, but I feel fine building the offense with him. That said, you know, if you told me I'm a D coordinator and I'm facing Drake Bell, I might not be dropping my eighth defender into the box every down either. So that's the case with Calvin Johnson. Is he's facing different coverages than Bryant. Teams still roll a lot of coverages over the top against Bryant, but he's more inclined to draw a one-on-one matchup than Murray is. So I think I would take Bryant in Dallas's system over Calvin Johnson in Detroit's system. I think I would. I don't feel
so
I could easily be talked out of this.
Just what he's surrounded by?
What's that?
Just by what he's surrounded by. So who's around him?
Well, based on his ability plus what he's surrounded by. I think if you look at Calvin Johnson, you have more reason to feel okay or more or comfortable dedicating extra attention to him versus Dez Bryant. In other words, Dez Bryant has better players around him.
But Andy, it wasn't long ago that the morons were already saying the decline of Calvin Johnson when you see a few weeks strung together when the numbers aren't there.
Were people saying that?
Yeah, that was starting to come out early on in the season, while Dez Bryant every week does something that just blows your mind. Washington, we saw did a great job in coverage against him, but other than Washington, who's played him well?
And what I admire about Dez Bryant is that he seems to embrace the double teams. You know, he has this reputation for being a hothead and all that stuff. What he is a really animated speaker who needs to understand that there's cameras on him when you do that. I know his position coaches like him.
And I love that
passion,
man.
His teammates are fine with him. You love that?
I love the ripping off the helmet on the sidelines, the throwing up the X celebration. I'll take everything.
Would you say he wants it?
Oh, he wants it bad.
Oh yeah, we're not. No more jokes on that. We don't mean to be every other, you know,
show
Yahoo
in the world,
out
yeah.
there. Calvin Johnson's 29 years old. He's not slowing down. And the Cowboys learned that very hard last year. He had over 300 receiving yards against them on 14 catches. So they better have a plan for him this time. And it can't be to sit back in cover three again and hope that Brandon Carr can disrupt his route off the line of scrimmage, because Brandon Carr's not going to disrupt that route.
The pressure, quote-unquote, in this game revolves around Tony Romo and can he win these big games. But we kind of lose sight of who Tony's playing in this one. Matthew Stafford, can he win the big game?
Yeah, because you saw that.
Because he wants it.
And none of this, you know, this whole wins the big
game
stuff.
That's not the point. That's not the point.
Yeah. A guy, Tony Romo doesn't go under center and think, you know, oh my gosh, I haven't won a playoff game in several years, and now I better complete this third down and eight pass. And Matthew Stafford doesn't go back in a shotgun and think about now that he's 0-17 on the road against, I think his teams with winning records was that Stafford.
0-16.
Fox team.
Yeah. After
well,
this
no,
week.
But that was going into the Green Bay game last week.
No, after Green Bay, it's 0-16.
Okay. Well, either way, it's an unfriendly record. But that's not relevant in this kind of thing. I think what is relevant is these guys' style of play, because sometimes there are reasons for why they, you know, can't win the big one or something. And with Romo and these late mistakes that we've seen him make in big stages, it's a coincidence that they've been on the big stage. He's made some on little stages as well. And the reason the mistakes happen is because he can be baited with certain coverages. Cover two traps, a great example, where it looks like cover two, but you're actually taking away an out route by the slot receiver. That's something Romo has struggled with before. Stafford can be baited into throwing in the traffic. We've seen that, especially with Calvin Johnson involved. And that's a big reason why he hasn't had success on the road against winning teams. Winning teams and teams on big stages where you're facing, that's going to be a team with a winning record in prime time, those are the teams that expose quarterbacks' flaws. And both of these guys are somewhat flawed, but we're probably talking a year or two late on this, because I think both have also had certainly the best season of their careers and very fine seasons by any standards.
Matthew Stafford having a great year this year. And Joe Lombardi, the offensive coordinator, used to work with Drew Brees, another one of those high-volume passers. How do you figure that that pairing with Stafford and Lombardi has worked out well? Stafford's having one of the best seasons of his career.
He is, and I think his numbers overall, aren't they down a little bit? I mean, they're not quite as gaudy.
About a tick down on attempts, yeah.
Yeah, and
completion percentage is up.
Coaches like Matthew Stafford, a lot of them believe they can coach him and they would want him. He's that, as one coach told me, he's that wild stallion. Give him to me and I'll tame him. And maybe Lombardi's done that a little bit. Something else that Stafford has done well this year, I think the arrival of Golden Tate has also helped, by the way, because that now they do have, and he was big when Johnson was out as a number one receiver, but overall he's that number two catch and run receiver.
Finally an extra dimension.
You're right, exactly. That's the dimension that had been missing. And I think they wanted another dimension with Eric Ebron, and he hasn't quite given them the full thing, but he's been good enough. I think they can be pleased with what they've seen as a, you know, from his first season. But Stafford's also better on the move this year. I mean, he's become more athletic. He and Matt Ryan were the two QBs this season that became better passers, better players overall on the move. And that helps his game a lot.
So where do you put Stafford then among the landscape of quarterbacks in this league? Is he slowly but surely climbing the ranks and getting within that top tier?
Well, you mean top tiers? I mean, you're talking
so
like,
the top third.
The top 10,
top 11, top 12 quarterbacks.
Yeah.
Are you putting Stafford in there right now?
Oh, boy, I'd have to go through and –
that's not hard.
Okay, right. Bear with me then. Let me go through and look at the. I mean,
just start listing. It's easy. Rodgers.
I think we can get right to the end discussion. Is he better than Romo? That's what it's going to come down to, the over under on the Romo line.
I think this season he is.
I think this season
he's doing more this season.
I think the numbers and even the film and the output says Romo's been the more stable and therefore more effective quarterback.
And
Keep in mind, Detroit's had a lot of complimentary.
Andy, you say it every week. He's complimentary.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean he's a nobody. But he's meant to play. And what we mean by complimentary is that he has a running game to take some. He's not throwing on every down. And so when you have a running game, then you have more of a play action element. Not that you need to run to set up play action, but your play action game is more expansive when your running game is more expansive. And that's helped Romo a lot. And then staying ahead in the down and distance as well. He's he's become a more disciplined player because he's had more reasons to play with discipline. He's been ahead in the down and distance, not throwing on third down and 11 so much. Stafford's the same way too, though. And I think that's a positive sign for the scheme, but I don't think Stafford and the Lions are quite as comfortable in their scheme as it may appear. If you look closely, they've fallen behind and not really generated much in a lot of games. And some of these fourth quarter comebacks, while they're great and they look good for a QB's Hall of Fame resume, they also mean you're falling behind in the first three quarters of games. And I think that offense isn't quite where they need it to be just yet. I'd say Romo's been the better QB this year. I don't know where Stafford ranks in the league. I would say he's probably 14 to 16 still, but I'd be happy if, you know, I could take him on my team. I mean, you can win playoff games with Matthew Stafford.
Saving the best for last, Cardinals on the road at the Panthers. Are either of these teams even a threat to do something in the playoffs this season? You don't want to hear it over and over again, but it is a legitimate question.
I hate to say this, and especially because ESPN, I'm happy to see them get a playoff game, and they've got to be saying, John Skipper privately in those Bristol offices has to be saying, are you kidding me?
Yeah, this is thanks
what we,
a lot.
We knew we weren't going to get the best game, but we fell into this because not only is it a losing team playing at home in the playoffs, they're facing a Cardinals team that's minus a lot of its starters, including its QB, and therefore that losing team at home is the favorite. I mean, That's a bad matchup. That's a bad matchup.
And it's football. It's NFL football, and we're talking about a bad playoff game.
Which might be why we're talking about it fourth here. I mean, thank you for continuing to listen. I think the good thing is it's the first playoff game as well, so it'll still be fun to watch. And I think these teams do match up to each other in very interesting ways, which we can get to. I know that you've got some angles you want to take on the game, so maybe we go through that.
Yeah, when they met last year, the Cardinals got to Cam Newton 7 times and came out with that 22-6 victory. If I put the over-under at 7 for sacks in this game,
I'd take the under.
Yeah, I think I would too.
I mean, 7's a big number. Maybe it is. A tougher question is 4. I think I'd take the under again. Here's what the game's going to come down to. I don't know if that's how relevant that stuff is this time around, and even the Todd Bowles and the blitzes and all that kind of stuff that we love to talk about with Arizona, because Carolina's become such a run-oriented offense, especially with this triple option stuff that they have with the receiver going into the backfield. And while Jericho Cotchery might not be the most dynamic running threat, you still have to have a body to account for him. So it's a great running game. And the other thing is it's a running game. I noticed this watching the film last week and tracking snap counts, or actually I look at the snap counts in the game book before I watch the film, but you can tell in the snap counts and just seeing them on film, they operate out of base personnel a lot. And the Cardinals are a dime defense. They don't play base personnel very much. They have Deion Buchanan at linebacker with Larry Foote, and it's a 6-DB package, more than 60% of the snaps this year. So if you're going to line up with two tight ends or two running backs in Carolina's case, I think the Cardinals are going to get dragged into playing a straight 3-4, or they've actually played more 4-3 lately, but they're going to have their base guys on the field, and that's a different defense with those base guys on the field. Not as fast of a defense.
It may be one of the worst matchup of the round, but I would much rather be a Panthers team with a losing record than the Cardinals at 11-5 moving forward.
Because of the quarterback injury?
No, because of you got the consistency of the running game starting to pick up. You got
for Carolina, you mean?
Yeah, got Cam Newton getting back into a bit of a rhythm, getting into the groove.
He's another guy that has helped being a complimentary guy. And the other reason that he's in a more of a rhythm with the passing game the way it is when you're throwing, if you're in base personnel, you're likely to have more passing attempts out of your base personnel. I mean, that's just simple logic, right?
Yeah.
And if you're throwing there, then you're facing the base packages, not the blitzes, and now all of a sudden your offensive line, which is still not very good in pass protection on the edges. Hats off to them, they've survived best they can, but they're not very good pass protectors on the edges. Well, that's not as big of an issue against base personnel, especially if those defensive front players are concerned about the running game perhaps. So Newton's getting simpler coverages to throw against, simpler pass designs. He's not having to drop back in a pocket and wonder about his protection as much. So it's all the more reason, if Carolina's to go anywhere in this postseason, and no, I don't think they can go deep, but I think that was our first question. Can your team go deep? No, the answer is no, but we're still going to talk about the game. if Carolina is to go anywhere in the postseason, say win this game, maybe get the championship, it's going to be on the running game, no question.
194 yards on the ground last week, and then in week 16, 209 on the ground. But they're going up against this Cardinals run defense, which at the midway point of the season was ranked second in the NFL. Now they're at 13th. What happened to this collapse here?
Yeah, that's odd. I'm trying to piece it together because
they're on the field a lot. That's got to be it, right?
Well, I'd have to look at the numbers. Watching the film, I haven't gotten the sense that this Cardinals defense is falling apart against the run. I haven't gotten that sense. I don't know if I have an answer for you on that one.
It seems a bit manipulative, too, because I first thought that it was because the offense is doing so poorly, the defense is on the field
that
a lot.
That could be it. That could be
But statistically, they're only on the field 1 minute longer than their opponents right now.
Oh, okay.
It's so not significant enough to grab a hold of.
If those opponents are playing with the lead, though, then they're getting more rushing attempts.
True.
Again. I mean, we could just look this kind of thing.
Yeah, we're
up,
just getting into a guessing game.
I don't know why
now.
We're not doing that. I'm looking like Seattle gave them trouble in the run game, of course, and some of that was the Russell Wilson factor. Keep in mind, not all rushing yards are actually rushing plays. I mean, these mobile quarterbacks, and they've faced a lot of mobile QBs lately. I'm looking at who they faced after or around Thanksgiving. It was Seattle. Atlanta's not a mobile QB, but Alex Smith in Kansas City does some read option stuff, and then Seattle again, and then San Francisco. So 4 out of 6 games against mobile quarterbacks. Those last two, they gave up over 200 yards rushing. Boy, 267 to Seattle, and that was that Sunday night thrashing. But recall, right, on that Sunday night thrashing, Russell Wilson gashed him a few times on passes where he happened to scramble. Those pass plays where you scramble, those should really be passing stats. I mean, it's the same effect as a sack, which a sack comes out of your net passing yards. It's the same thing. You're out of a passing formation with a pass play called against a pass defense, probably on a passing down, like third and long. Why are they running stats anyway?
That's a good point. You have a lot of outrage with how the league is viewed and managed.
Are poorly kept. Maybe we need more Neil Hornsby's out there or something.
There
more Aaron Schatz is taking care of this stuff, I guess. But I don't know if their run defense has actually fallen apart so much. I think now as we talk through this, I think it's more that they've come up against some running quarterbacks. But guess who they're facing this weekend? So maybe it is a factor. Cam Newton's going to run on them too.
If the Panthers can't get that running game going, though, is there any chance of them winning this game?
Nope.
That's it?
No chance
whatsoever. Maybe I'll ask the same question for the Cardinals offense. Can they win if the ground game is eliminated and you put this game in the hands of a quarterback that doesn't really know what he's doing when he's on the field?
Well, that'd be Ryan Lindley, right? Who wasn't?
That would be whoever's healthy that they put in right now.
But I would take a little bit of umbrage on that if it's Drew Stanton, because I think Stanton does. I think he's been respectable. Where his problems have come, in fact, is where he, I guess this is not knowing what you're doing, but where he feels he knows too much. He throws with decisiveness and conviction, and that has gotten him into trouble because there's been a few times that he's misread the coverage and done that. That will be a problem now. I don't know. Carolina's not a big-time disguising coverage team. They're more likely to line up and just play against you. So maybe that's not as big of an issue. But if it's Drew Stanton, I assume it's Drew Stanton in there, isn't it? He's
yes.
So he's a healthy guy. It's Stanton or Lindley. You know, they're probably not going to. If they're smart, they won't tell us for sure. But I think it's going to be Drew Stanton. Then they can still do their full array of passing concepts. They don't have to dumb down the playbook at all.
All right, you ready to get into coaches?
Yeah, I think we're good to go there.
Okay, so the changes from around the league. We'll start off first with Chicago. Mark Trestman, he's out. Phil Emery is out as GM. What do you make of this? Year two, he's already done.
I think that the McCaskey family decided we need to make a sweeping move here. I think the fan base I'd heard was getting a little bit, not apathetic, but more interested in, like, Michael Wilbon, who knows Chicago, said that the Blackhawks, the Cubs, the White Sox, and certainly the Bulls were starting to get ahead of the Bears in the town's pecking order. And when you start hearing that around town, or if you get that sense, I guess you make a sweeping coaching change. We'll talk about the football side of it in a second after we get to these candidates here. But I was a little surprised that they got rid of Trestman as well, but I understand it.
I almost think that he didn't – there wasn't a lot of choice here because the order of operations bringing him in was wrong. You wanted a guy to be able to fix your big investment in Jay Cutler. that doesn't get done. And you start firing people. Is that the right way to go?
Well, so Cutler stays and everybody else goes. I mean, that's what happened.
That's the opposite of what we thought. I thought Mark Trestman was going to stay. Phil Emery, who knows? I mean, probably out. But Jay Cutler, a trade, something.
Emery made the investment in Cutler, so I understand you have to. If Cutler doesn't produce and you can't financially just dump him, then I guess Emery's the guy that gets axed from it. What's interesting and I think disappointing, by the way, is that Chicago's holding on to all of their assistants right now. And that really screws those guys over, because what happens is a new coach comes in, maybe in a few weeks, most likely a new GM as well, and they want to hire their own staff. So now they release this staff. Yeah, that's fine. I would hope you feel that way. If you're a head coach and come in and say, I'll just take the guys I got here as assistants, and they hired the wrong head coach, you'd better have your own staff. But so now when he hires his staff, he releases Mel Tucker and all the, you know, Aaron Cromer is lucky he got fired, but Mel Tucker's still on there. All the assistants along the offensive line, defensive line, those position coaches, they now get fired 2 weeks or 3 weeks later, and other coaching staffs at that point have started to be filled out. I've seen this happen, and I've seen coaches who I know and like and have good personal relationships get wedged out of the league this way. And so I'm not thrilled that that's how they chose to do that. I think if you're going to fire the coach, you need to fire the staff with them. Do them that courtesy.
The only other direct firing from the NFC came with Mike Smith in Atlanta. Arthur Blank is clearly upset with how things have worked out there. Thomas Dimitroff may also be leaving quickly
Dimitroff's now maybe on thin ice, which every job in the NFL, you're on thin ice.
Yeah.
So Dimitroff, I'm sure, is just fine with that. You know, the Mike Smith one, I take that as it's just a time for change, because the Falcons had never had back-to-back winning seasons before Mike Smith came along. And then they had five in a row under him. And I think he won two Coach of the Year awards. He was certainly a leading candidate twice.
And he's leaving with a record 20 games over 500. The last two have not been good.
Mike Smith has a lot to be proud of in Atlanta, the way he did his job. He had a very successful tenure there. He was there, I think, 7 years. And that's it now. The last 2 years, things did dry up a little bit, and it's a competitive business. And Arthur Blank, you're almost obligated at that point to make a change, because the Falcons, they got nailed by injuries last year, but they didn't get nailed by injuries so much this year. And every team also, to a certain degree, gets nailed by injuries. You supposedly have your franchise QB in Matt Ryan, then you ought to be able to overcome most injuries. And maybe it's a lot to ask them to overcome Julio Jones and that offensive line last season. But it's the NFL. It's the way it goes. It just is reality.
And I think that the thing about this season, too, none of these are really coming at a huge surprise. Rex Ryan, John Idzik, both out in New York. That Broadway show is done and gone with.
Yeah. And then the last one, of course, Jim Harbaugh and San Fran, and that's a surprise to nobody.
Which is apparently a mutual departure. They were both good.
Well, it might be now because he's the highest paid coach in Michigan, so maybe he does feel mutually okay about that.
He's okay with $8 million a year or something like that.
I couldn't believe he went to Michigan.
Really?
No NFL coach has ever left the NFL and then gone to college on successful terms, like gone to college the very next year. Bill Walsh left and went to Stanford 3 years later, so he didn't leave the NFL for college. Nick Saban left Miami, no successful NFL coach. Nick Saban left and went from Miami to Alabama, and that's fine. He wasn't any good in Miami. It didn't work out. Dave Wannstedt went to Pittsburgh. I think he'd been in Chicago shortly, but I know he had. I think it was right before that he went, or Miami, excuse me. But, you know, Dave Wannstedt was not a big-time NFL coach. Guys don't leave the NFL at the top of the mountain and jump down to college, because – coaching college is a pain in the ass. You have to deal with boosters,
parents,
and NCAA, parents, NCAA regulations, professors even. And then also young kids.
Become a babysitter.
I mean, it's a totally different job. And there is so much, I would guess, there's so much about it that has nothing to do with football. And if Jim Harbaugh's, you know, the thing, he has been in college before, though, so he knows what he's getting into. But if he's not the people person, and you hear whispers that maybe he's not, I don't know how well he fits in coaching. I think a guy like that needs to be in the NFL where it's a meritocracy. Of course, wasn't a meritocracy in San Francisco, I guess, because if it were, he'd still have a job there.
I think that fiery personality that Jim Harbaugh has, though, could really thrive in that situation, that scenario where he's basically the Elway of a college. He's getting so much control, and the best resources in the nation might as well try it out. It's not working in San Francisco.
And then also $8 million a year. Now, you know, honestly, he's irrelevant to me until he comes back. I just have no interest in
he's
college
dead
football.
To you.
I mean, I don't want to say – I was thinking that, but I don't want to say dead to me. But and I guess maybe take some of his assistants with him. As far as you mentioned Ryan and the Jets, you know, that we saw that one coming. And again, that's another one kind of like Mike Smith where it was just time for a change. And I think Ryan has a lot to be proud of his tenure with the Jets. He didn't have a ton to work with on offense there. He's a defensive guy. He did things his way. And they went to two AFC championship games his first 2 years. And they were competitive most years. They haven't been as good as of late. But I liked Rex Ryan as a head coach. I thought he did a good job there.
Even if the question isn't can Rex Ryan coach, because I think he's a good coach too, does anyone want to take on the what goes on with Rex Ryan?
I think that stuff gets overblown. I mean, he's a little bombastic with the media. There might be, you know, you might catch him doing something mildly inappropriate away from the scene. Like, you know, I think he flipped someone off at a WWE event a few years ago.
He would go to those.
What was he even doing there? Yeah. But and you know, pictures of him on the beach hanging around the wife with the foot fetish thing, which people forget about. That was a big deal for a while.
Was.
It's not relevant though, so I'm glad people forgot about it. But all that's so ancillary. I mean, that stuff, none of that stuff equals the pain of one loss in of an NFL game, one Sunday that doesn't come out your way. So I don't think that's a problem. I wouldn't worry about the personality if I hire Rex Ryan. I think what's interesting is John Idzik also got canned. And what I like about what they did in Atlanta is they held on to Dimitroff and fired Smith, which makes sense from a 30,000-foot logical perspective. Because if you think about it, why does Mike Smith get fired? Well, the team underachieved. Well, in order to underachieve, that means you must feel that you have a pretty good team. Who put together the team? Thomas Dimitroff. So you keep him. In New York, though, you fire the coach and the GM. Those seem to almost be contrasting thoughts. You know, like the if a
like
coach
everyone's
goes,
wrong. We don't know what's wrong, but everyone's wrong.
Right, and that's exactly. And that sounds like how Woody Johnson does business. And he made a mistake in hiring John Idzik, but is it his fault he made the mistake? Because if I recall, there were about 12 candidates who didn't even want to be interviewed for that job, which also tells you how Woody Johnson's viewed around the league. I don't think people want to go work for Woody Johnson. And they're going to have a problem filling that spot, perhaps, because if they had a problem a year ago finding a GM candidate, maybe it's because the GMs didn't want to deal with Rex Ryan. That could be it. I doubt it, though.
You're drifting farther and farther away from those seasons of success, too. It's not as recent.
I think people don't want to deal with Woody Johnson as the owner.
Do you want to get into some of these candidates for some of these positions, assistants around the league? I think that was your method, right? So not the multitude of former coaches or potential coaches around the world, but guys in the league active right now.
Yeah, it's actually an idea that Peter gave me. And then Peter had us do our top five executive. No, well, we did executives too, but top five assistant coaches for our MMQB awards. So I had to go through the assistant coaches anyway. So I went through the whole league and just my film notes and off of what I've seen this year and picked out assistants that people need to know. And some of them they already do and some they don't. So you want to should we just list these off?
Yeah, go for it. Especially the most popular ones we can get out of the way right off the bat.
Okay, and I'm just going to list them. I did them in order of like divisions. I just went down here's a promo. I went on the Our Lads depth chart thing.
There you go.
And just looked at all the, and they go by divisions.
We love Our Lads.
They do a good job. So starting in the AFC East, and then we'll just work our way through. I won't announce the division. So Josh McDaniels, New England offensive coordinator. Hugh Jackson from Cincinnati. James Urban, Cincinnati's wide receiver coach. He's not going to get a head coaching job soon. He might be a coordinator candidate, but I wanted to put his name on the radar because, for one, the Bengals have done a great job developing Green, which isn't a tough guy to develop, but also Mohamed Sanu, Marvin Jones before this year, and even something small like Greg Little came in mid-season for them and played very well his first game. And there's a consistency to the improvement of Cincy's wide receivers, and Urban's a big reason for that. He was also Michael Vick's quarterback coach in Philadelphia in 2010, the year Vick had his best season. That's a great coaching job. That's not easy to go coaching Vic in those circumstances under Andy Reid, who's a totally different type of guy to work for than Marvin Lewis, by the way. So anyway, James Urban is the guy to put out there. And one other note is the reason there's a lot of Bengal candidates out every year. And I think one reason is that since these scouting departments very small, and it's partly the cheapness of ownership there, but also Mike Brown likes to keep things tight and in-house. But what happens, John, is these assistant coaches then have to go out and scout the rookies coming in. So they have big-time responsibilities. So like a guy like James Urban, he's responsible for bringing in the wide receivers as well. Now, he doesn't make the draft picks, but he's the guy that does the main legwork on it. So you get all kinds of different – when you have a small staff like Cincy does, you get all kinds of unique responsibilities that I think is the type of thing that makes a guy a good head coaching candidate.
So have you talked to someone in Cincinnati's organization before about him? I just can't believe you've stumbled upon a wide receivers coach in Cincinnati.
Well,
I don't think anyone else would point to that.
I didn't mean to go that long on James Urban. It was just a conceptual thing, though. I mean, he's done. I want to explain. I'm gonna have to explain some. Like, I don't need to explain Hugh Jackson. We know what Hugh Jackson does.
Past experience, yeah.
But when I say James Urban, wide receiver coach, there's no point in me saying that unless I tell people who he is and what he does. And also, I think our listeners will appreciate just hearing the kind of things that go on within the league as far as who these assistants are and what goes into the jobs. And I don't know as much about other teams as Cincinnati. I mean, I heard this and I had it explained to me in great depth. So that's how I know about how the Bengals do business there. But some teams, like look at New England, they don't have a lot of great assistants that become great head, or they have great assistants maybe, but that become great head coaches. I mean, Romeo Cornell didn't do well after he left. Charlie Weiss it did not work out at all well. Josh McDaniels failed his first time around with Denver. The Patriots don't necessarily produce great assistants, but the Bengals, who ask more of their assistants and don't have that Belichickian figure reigning over them.
The tyranny, yeah.
Yeah, then they do have good assistants. You know, it's the kind of thing that I don't know if people think about as much.
I would never think about that, actually.
I wouldn't either until it was, you know, that's why I go to the combine. I love this because you got to learn how the league works. Yeah, and so I'll run through the rest of it. I'm doing offensive coaches.
Okay, hit the rest on the offensive end.
Kyle Shanahan in Cleveland, I thought he did a great job this year, and I thought he did a very good job with RG3 in Washington as well. Mike Munchak, who's a former head coach, Pittsburgh's offensive line, we talked about that earlier. Charlie Williams in Indianapolis, he's not a head coaching candidate. He's frankly too old for that.
Okay, so then who are the – you're throwing in guys that aren't even candidates in our candidate list here. I'm confused.
Because I was making a list.
I think you're showing off now. You're showing off a little bit of your range of knowledge here.
This isn't knowledgeable. I mean, just look at how the Colts wide receivers have played. That's all it is. I mean, I know Charlie Williams isn't a candidate because he's too old and he's too far down the ladder at this point, but his position group has played very well over the years and it continues to get better. I mean, a guy like T.Y. Hilton has developed gradually.
Sure, yeah.
And Williams has worked in multiple systems because he had the Bruce Arians thing and then Pep Hamilton. So I just want to give people ideas of the type of things
to think about. Okay, I got you on that.
So you develop players in multiple systems. That you're a good communicator. That's a good assistant coach there. Adam Gase in Denver, of course, and he'll get a job at some point very soon. I think he's smart. I think he realizes – the longer he stays with Manning, the better off it is for him, even if he remains a coordinator for an extra year or two.
So what do you think of possible snarky slights at Adam Gase saying he's just really more of an assistant to Peyton Manning in this offense?
Adam Gase might tell you, yeah, that's kind of true. And as a coach and a smart coach, my job's to be an assistant to possibly the best quarterback of all time. I mean, it's Peyton Manning. There's different rules with Manning. Gase also worked under Mike Martz for a while, and he worked in Detroit as well. He's worked in a lot of different offensive systems. He's a confident guy. He's pretty young. You know, he'll be a head coach soon. I don't know if he'll do it quite this year, though.
Interesting. He'll probably wait with Manning then until Manning's expired.
That would be good timing. I mean, he might go. But he's in a great spot. Let's put it that way, because he's very desired, and I think it's for the right reasons. It does help that he's playing with Manning, though. Eric Bieniemy in Kansas City, he's had some interim experience in Kansas City. Niall Davis played well. Jamal Charles is very good in that system. Bieniemy's well-respected throughout the league. John DeFilippo in Oakland is a quarterback's coach, respected among his staff. And I thought Derek Carr had a great showing this season.
Evolution, too. Because
yeah,
what we saw in week one and then week, say, four or five, you're things are jumping out.
Yeah. Now, a guy like, and they call him Flip around the league, thank God, because that's a tough name to get through. A guy like John Flip needs to have a few more years under him. You can't just have one decent season
with
from
a rookie,
your rookie
quarterback,
QB and Elsa. I mean, yeah, that isn't, that's not enough evidence. And he didn't do so, you know, he did okay with Terrell Pryor. He didn't have the resources there. If you don't have a quarterback to work with, you're not going to look like a very good quarterback coach. But anyway, that's a name to float on the radar, and I think he'll be an offensive coordinator someday. Joe DeAlessandris from San Diego. We talked about him a few shows ago. I've never met him. I don't know him, but San Diego's offensive line was really good mediocre players.
A lot of these guys that seem to pop out to you, though, this is more like a possible coordinator jump, all these assistants, because a jump from wide receivers coach or running backs coach to head coaching is very, very
I'm probably going too wide of a scope here, but I think people, and if you don't care, just fast forward. We're gonna talk about the filling who's going to go where in a minute.
Your Dan Quinns, your Adam Gase is a little more.
People need to start knowing these names, though. I mean, it's even if it's 2 or 3 years in advance. And DeAlessandris is, I think he's an older coach as well, so he's probably not going to become. You know, some guys like to be position coaches, and that's just where they want to be. I wanted to get him out. You know, good coaches need to be recognized. Scott Linehan's another one in Dallas. He's a former head coach. Did a great job with Bill Callahan. Those two, I don't know how they worked together this year. I mean, I wasn't in the room, but it seemed to be pretty good to me. I mean, just based on how...
On the product.
Yeah, I mean,
what we saw on the field is all that matters.
Callahan's a run game coordinator, and Linehan's a pass game coordinator. That seems like a recipe for disaster, but Linehan wound up running the ball more. And Callahan's offensive line is probably the best in the league. Might be the best in the last decade. That's a young group he worked with as well. Mike Shula in Carolina, I like the run game designs. And then Greg Roman, who... we've heard maybe he's going to Michigan.
Yeah, which I can't see that happening.
Greg Roman was a big-time head coaching candidate when the year the Niners were in the Super Bowl recently.
I think he's still a pretty big candidate.
I agree,
On this list of the offensive guys, he's right there in the top four of with Gase, McDaniels, Jackson, these guys that we think would be very, very big candidates.
Fascinating guy to talk football with as well.
Greg Roman?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and that's something you got to keep in mind because he's – if these guys can't communicate, they're not going to make good coaches, head coaches. I mean, even position coaches. But there's a difference. As an offensive coordinator, Greg Roman sits in a room and studies tape and moves chess pieces around for a living. Then he calls plays. He doesn't necessarily have to communicate with the players quite the same way. And if, as a head coach, he has to organize everything that goes on in the building, of course.
Right.
Those are the offensive guys. I'm going to get through the defensive guys a little bit quicker here to pick it up. Also, we've got a list. Jim Schwartz, Buffalo D coordinator, did a great job. Paul Gunther this year. Mark Carrier, Cincinnati's defensive backs coach.
Cincinnati's just a breeding ground.
And I don't know if Mark Carrier has head coaching aspirations or not. But Bengals, they're a very well-coached secondary, and you can tell by the volume of coverages that they're able to give those guys and – the kind of work they get out of veteran players, even. It's easier maybe to coach veterans, except that Terrence Newman had a reputation for being inconsistent with his technique, leaving Dallas, coming into Cincinnati years ago, and Mike Zimmer turned him around there. But then also Adam Jones, he's probably not the easiest guy to coach.
And young guys, George Iloka, what he's been able to get out of George Iloka in these first couple of years has been pretty astounding.
And Reggie Nelson and Cincinnati as well. Keep in mind, Reggie Nelson was a first-round bust in Jacksonville. Yeah. I mean, a high first-round pick. Carnell Lake in Pittsburgh, former Pro Bowl cornerback. Now he coaches the DBs there. He doesn't want to be a head coach. I know that for sure. He likes being – he's one of those loves being a position coach guys.
Yeah.
So that works. We could put Dick LeBeau on here, but he's not going to be a candidate, of course. Romeo Crennel's not a candidate, but his Houston Texans had a very good season. Greg Minuski in Indianapolis, that's a candidate. Probably not quite for this year, but that's a name that's going to get floated more and more. And the Colts did a great job, as we talked about earlier, of manufacturing pressure on defense with Robert Mathis out of the lineup.
Seems like any time you get when you put a guy next to an overachieving defense or offense, like Indianapolis with the loss of Robert Mathis, we thought would be an even bigger factor than it turned out to
be.
Then you're on the short list right there. If you get more out of your guys, you're an easy target for these head coaching jobs.
Yeah, it's overachievement's always that's a first sign of good coaching. You want to, I mean, that's the obvious sign of good coaching,
sure.
I would think. Jack Del Rio in Denver. I'd be interested to see if he gets another shot somewhere. You know, he left on bad terms in Jacksonville. Yeah. There's questions about his work ethic, and I don't know if that was fair or unfair. I wasn't there, but you don't hear questions about work ethic with head coaches very often at all. Bob Sutton in Kansas City, Emmett Thomas, who, you know, is an old coach, but his assistant DB coach there in Kansas City, Emmett Thomas is the DB coach. Al Harris is the assistant. His players love him, and a lot of them credit him for their development. And Kansas City's secondary was third against the pass, I believe, this season.
I love Sean Smith. Sean Smith's like my favorite cornerback in the league.
Why?
I will have all biases. I love big corners. He's like 6'3".
Yeah.
He plays great man coverage. You've made me fall in love with man cover corners, you know?
Yeah, I'd like what to am see I to Sean do? Smith in a Seattle scheme or something.
Oh.
Yeah.
What, like a Brandon Browner type?
Yeah. He's more athletic than Browner, though, big time. Al Harris is a guy that can teach you how to play that kind of technique, too. I mean, Al Harris learned how to – he invented defensive holding. John Pagano, we talk about him all the time. Someone needs to give him a head coaching job.
I mean, San Diego defensive coordinator.
Yeah, and he's done it with a lot of different things in San Diego.
Overachieving.
Yep. There Rod Marinelli in Dallas, talk about overachieving there. I wouldn't hire him as a head coach. Matt Eberflus, Dallas's linebacker coach. It's a name that just gets thrown around privately throughout the league. He was there under Rob Ryan, and he was actually a Rob Ryan guy, and then he's a holdover. So if you think about that, Eberflus and the Cowboys linebackers, they played real well this year. Anthony Hitchens and Rolando McClain, those were the linebackers given to him, and that defense actually played well. I mean, that's enough to put him on the radar. But he also helped bring Sean Lee into the league. Bruce Carter was good initially. He's tailed off, unfortunately. But he did that with those guys in Rob Ryan's scheme. So Eberflus has coached 3-4 linebackers and a blitz-type man-oriented coverage scheme. And then he's coached 4-3 zone linebackers, and he's had success in both ways. And he's respected around the league, too. It's a name you hear whispered a lot. Jerome Henderson is Dallas's DB coach. I know nothing about him, but Dallas played with Sterling Moore this year in their nickel package. That's a guy they picked up off the street and played well. And their safeties are, you know, just guys. Yeah.
Orlando Scandrick screaming at everyone on the sidelines.
Yeah, well, maybe Jerome Henderson's motivated him or something. I don't know. Bill Davis, Philly's D coordinator, had a good year. Terrell Austin and Detroit, he's getting some interviews, and that makes perfect sense because that Lions defense skyrocketed in a hurry.
That was a top-ranked defense for 5-6 weeks.
Yeah, and they finished number one against the run, and they were pretty good against the pass, and their personnel didn't change. He got Rasheen Mathis to play in something other than a zone scheme for a little bit. There.
He got Aaron Rodgers to make mistakes.
Yeah, that's right. Like, there it is.
That happened twice.
His linebacker under Chiano, and then he was a high-up defensive coach with the Giants. I think he's even a D coordinator at one point with the Giants. So he's been around. He's not going to be a head coach, but Detroit's linebackers all had career years, and I don't think it's a whole lot of a coincidence that Bill Sheridan came in and coached them this year. And then another Detroit Lions guy, Alan Williams, who was Minnesota's D coordinator, quietly under Leslie Frazier last year and in the previous years, and now he coached a secondary that really overachieved. And Alan Williams is always a zone, you know, he's Tampa 2 coaches here, but they don't do that Tampa 2 stuff in Detroit anymore. So he's had to learn on the job, on the fly a little bit, I'm guessing.
We are coming up to some major candidates, though. These guys.
You saw the list. You got the list.
Yeah, I'm cheating a little bit.
Well, Darren Perry for Green Bay, who's their safeties coach, but I think he does a lot more than that. In fact, I was told that a lot of people feel he won the Super Bowl for Green Bay when they played against Pittsburgh because Darren Perry had been on that Steelers staff. And so he understood a lot, in fact, maybe all of Pittsburgh's coverage rules. And coverages aren't flawless. You have some weaknesses and liabilities. And Green Bay, with the help of Perry, who helped the offensive staff that week, Green Bay installed several packages and plays that deliberately exploited the coverage rules. And it was an amazing tactical advantage that the Packers had. It contributed to several big plays in that game. And I think that's what really helped get his name going around the league. He has his hands in a lot of different areas. He's not just the safeties coach.
Which shows some sign of potential there for a head coaching gig.
Versatility, yeah. And his name's been he's been a candidate for several years as well. Joe Witt, Jerry Gray for Minnesota's defensive backs. And he's working with Mike Zimmer there. And Zimmer's a great DBs coach. Even as a head coach, he still works I know as a coordinator, he worked closely with the DBs. I would imagine, and I saw him at training camp working closely with the DBs, even as a head coach, giving that one-on-one training. But Jerry Gray's a guy that can also do that as well. Hear the names. Todd Bowles of fire person because he's done it with a ton of schemes.
Especially this season, too. We talk about with all the guys injuries. Without your pieces. Yeah, look at San Francisco.
Yep. Ed Donatell in San Francisco, defensive backs coach. Jim Leavitt, San Francisco's linebackers coach. So the 49ers have had a great scheme, and a lot of these guys will probably be available too now. You're no right. surprise. Dan Quinn in Seattle, I think he'll get a job this year.
I love all the tweets we're seeing. Blank team is going to make a call to Dan Quinn, or blank team is going to call Adam Gase. Everyone's calling Adam Gase and Dan Quinn right now.
Oh, they're all getting probably calls. Calling half the guys on this list, and they're probably calling another 30 guys that I've never even thought of. Yeah. I mean, this is guys that so there are a lot of good coaches out there. We don't know them all. And the last one, though, is Chris Richard in Seattle because he's their DB coach. And I don't know. I've heard Pete Carroll has his hands firmly on the teachings at cornerback there and even safety. But whoever's teaching, though, because every one of them is a low-drafted guy who comes in and plays like an all-pro. And even Simon, the fifth-round pick last year, unknown guy, had a very good tenure this season when he was in there for a few games. Jeremy Lane, Kyron, whoever's teaching these guys, and I figure Chris Richards got to be doing some of it because he's the DB
coach. Pete Carroll doesn't want anyone to know that. He'll keep that inside. That'll be the secret.
Anyway, that's the list of offensive and defensive coaches.
All we have for you guys this week. Next week, we'll run through a lot of these similar headlines because these head coaching changes may continue to happen as time goes on, get into more playoff stuff. Remember to subscribe on iTunes to the podcast. Just search MMQB Podcast, and you'll be all set.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.